interested in the paranormal, murder mystery, real natural law? Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crip Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crip Rick's Ivan Baker. Welcome to the Crypt.
Many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the day from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom!
The future is uncertain. I know this. Death is inevitable. I know this. But one thing is certain. As free men, it is our right to live unencumbered and in peace. And those times are quickly drawing to an end. And in these times, peace is certainly an illusion. And as the chains grow tighter, our ability to slip those chains increase incrementally with every passing moment. Inaction is no longer an option. It's time to raise our voices like a cacophony of thunder and lightning, and tell the masters no more. And this is Nighthawk, and I say, for myself, no more. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, because the freedom is slipping away.
Now is the time for Counterspeech with Dina Sachs. Dina will guide us through the convoluted corridors of the American legal system, and she will explain how the people can reclaim their country and restore true democracy.
Hi, everyone. This is Dina Sachs, and this is Counter Speech on Revolution Radio. I have Stanford Graham on with me today. Thank you, Stanford, so much for joining me.
It is a true pleasure, Dina. Great to be with you.
Thank you so much. We met recently on a Zoom call discussing some of the cases that various entities are bringing, and you're with Prosecute Now. Is that right?
That's right.
And you're bringing all sorts of cases trying to, you know, establish that we still have constitutional rights and the contours of those rights, correct?
That's right. Not just the penumbra, but the real thing.
Right. Well, that's what's so strange about what's going on right now is that some of our most basic rights are being infringed, and they may not be the enumerated rights. So we're not talking about the Bill of Rights that are actually, you know, set forth specifically. We're talking about substantive due process, which is basically the Liberty Clause. All the things that make our lives meaningful, all the things we care about, all the things that give us freedom, those are all found implicitly in the Liberty Clause. The right not to be told what to do in so many ways unless the government has a really specific and meaningful reason. And particularly when it comes to our bodies, the right has always been protected very fiercely, both in our Constitution and in American common law, and going back all the way to English common law, you know, as early as, almost ancient times. I mean, the right to be left alone, to be, to have your bodies not be touched is so basic. So tell me a little bit about your case about tell me about Dr. Greiner, first of all. He sounds like a really wonderful man.
Well, he is, but right before I get to that, I want to, maybe because you won't say it about yourself, but I've just today enjoyed your amicus brief, the Nations in Action case in the Third Circuit, and I appreciate the historical context analysis that you bring to the Liberty Clause. I think there's a very there's a significant lack of appreciation, even recognition of where that these the fundamental right, as you properly point out, not enumerated, but very fundamental right not to be touched. Just very basic. The fact that you tied it back to battery law and trespass law was at the same time simultaneously surprising and as well as, well, of course it does. You know, I think it's actually one of those truths that we lose sight of because it's transparent. It's so obvious.
I know. Well, that's the thing, is that people know they have these rights. Americans know. But they don't know why. They don't know how. They don't know how to prove it. And most lawyers don't either. And the reason why is because we go over the Liberty Clause cases in a few days in our constitutional law class in law school. And unless you teach it and study it in detail and write and publish about it, it's really just not an area of law that is very popular. It's sort of an area of law that you just assume. I know for many years I assume the ACLU will take care of anything for me. You know, anything comes up, we can rely on the ACLU, you know. And so what we're finding right now is that we can't rely on anyone but ourselves. And so we're seeing a lot of lawyers who are not constitutional scholars and not constitutional litigators, you know, taking these cases on because they know something's really wrong. I've seen a lot of problems in the cases, and I think that it's the kind of thing where the federal courts are presented with these issues all the time. They are experts. The U.S. attorneys are experts. Our attorney generals of the states are experts, but our average lawyers are not. In fact, even the top-notch lawyers are not experts in the Liberty Clause. They just don't. They don't litigate it. And one thing,
there's not enough exposure to be familiar with the terrain. Or not just to really know the terrain.
Right, and to broaden the picture up more, just to give a clear context, when you do any kind of constitutional or federal civil rights litigation, there are so many places where you can fall in. It's almost like going through a landmine, and they've set it up that way. I mean, I don't mean to sound cynical, but they've set it up so that plaintiffs will fail, because as time has gone on over the past 20 years, you could argue about how long it's gone on and how bad it's gotten and how recently, but civil rights are being violated every single day in this country. For a police officer to come up to you and ask you for your ID, which I heard happened to you recently, I mean, why? Why? I mean, you shouldn't be asking.
Very strange incident last night. Very strange. Yeah.
So when you look at that, this is why they do that. Well, they do it, and they get so audacious with their civil rights violations because they know that it's going to be very hard to get a lawyer. And even if you are a lawyer, and even if you're a very good lawyer, it's going to be very hard to litigate against these government attorneys because they do it all the time, and they're the ones that created the pitfalls. So they know the pitfalls. It is very difficult for a lawyer who doesn't litigate this kind of action to navigate through this. And I've done it myself for a few years, and so I know. I brought Section 1983 claims against the government, and I brought federal statutory claims under the Equal Pay Act 7. So I know what they do to plaintiffs, and it's not just the opposing counsel. And by the way, a lot of times the opposing counsel, the state or government attorneys, they're supposed to be enforcing these rights. And then ironically, when they're not enforced, they're called upon to defend the government actors who violate our rights. So
it's a very strange set of bedfellows.
Yes, so, it is. And what I'm seeing, just like in the Harvey Weinstein case, just like in the Jeffrey Epstein case, I'm seeing the government attorneys behave like Alan Dershowitz or Ken Starr, one of these, you know, defense attorneys who do things that really aren't ethical. And they do things that will thwart justice, thwart the plaintiff's case, attack the plaintiff, not give over evidence. Everything we've seen in the defense bar that's wrongful, I've seen the same thing in the Attorney General's Office of Texas. And I'm not the only one. I have affidavits from two other females who say that Ken Paxton's attorneys are really mistreating the female plaintiffs. They happen to be lawyers in these cases. I'm saying they all happen to be lawyers, but I meant to say female plaintiffs. And some of it's really pretty bad. And so eventually, and I apologize for the noise. We have jets going over right now. I came out of the surf, as you can tell, I've got the surfer hit. And I stopped at the beach to make this call. And on rare occasion, Point Wainimi or somebody flies a plane. So I apologize to the listeners. But anyway, let's dig in a little bit to your wonderful client.
Dr. Griner.
What a superstar. What a sweet person. Tell us about his background.
Yeah, remarkable. He, in high school, he determined that he was going to practice medicine and specifically wanted to serve children, and even more specifically, children with cleft palates. He served as he went on a mission tour with some doctors and observed children in third world countries who had these terrible cleft palates, and these doctors who were going abroad to bring, you know, services to these kids that would obviously change their lives in so many different ways, to, you know, returning again and again and again because of these corrective congenital originated surgeries. You know, like a cleft palate or other congenital deformities require multiple surgeries over years of time to get the best results in, for the health of the child as well as the social benefit of the child, right? And so he's done this for decades. And like I say, in high school, he determined this is what he wanted to do. And so he is a brilliant physician. That's a great backdrop. Jeez.
This is real, guys, out there. See this on Rumble. That's real. That's where I am. It's amazing right here. I just want to show that while you're speaking, but please go on.
So he's just a beautiful human being. He's an exceptional physician and a beautiful human being. He and his wife, they actually originated a foundation in Utah called Utah Smiles. And so for decades, they have raised funds and provided these, you know, if you can imagine being a parent, you know, looking at your child for the first time and understanding what a significant, you know, a cleft palate is going to mean for that child. Well, for just basic activities like eating and then speaking and then the social stigma that goes along with that. People at Dina have no resources to bring about the, provide for their children these kinds of services. And actually, I was at a gathering at a fundraiser for this Utah Smiles Foundation just within the last month. And I tell you, it was very emotional. Not what I expected. It's the first time I attended one of these for Dr. Griner, and to see these children and to hear them tell their stories and to see the love that they had for Devin Griner, for Dr. Griner and his staff. It was truly moving. And so to think that you can have a federal government initiate knee-jerk reaction mandates, get way over the way over the top of their skis, not trying to make the mandates the least intrusive, not trying to find alternatives for that may provide better outcomes than mandates of experimental injections. All these things, you pit that kind of entity that seems to be acting out of the ultra vires actions like police powers to come between the relationship that a physician has with his patient.
Right.
And to do it without any kind of licensing, you know, medical practice licensing, without any authorization by states that actually govern that kind of practice, you know, that those professions. It's bizarre. It's truly bizarre. And to see, to understand that that's in large part what's going on in this country over the last few years with these mandates, really inserting the federal government between physicians and their patients, which used to be a sacrosanct relationship. So, well, you know, Dr. Grant is just phenomenal that way, and humble and brilliant.
Right. So that's what I really want the listeners to hear, is what kind of person we're talking about who is not allowed to practice his trade, just saving children, making their lives much better, making them presentable and making them confident, making them being able to eat properly. And this is a man who is not an average person by any means. This is a true superstar, kind of an angel on earth. And he's not allowed because he won't take a experimental vaccine that's being pushed on the people it doesn't work anyway. So, but it's so outrageous. And so I think it's really important to, I mean, everyone has the right to reject the vaccine, but the idea the government would coerce someone at the level where they're actually actively hurting so many children, what, for the possibility that he may not infect them with a coronavirus that they're going to get over anyway?
And you here's two things that are two facts that are actually shocking. Two statements, minimally, if you break it down in the Federal Register, the argument that the administration made to justify that the mandate was number one. Well, they actually stated on the record that the biggest motivation that the mandate would impose for compliance was loss of employment. That's the driving factor that they wanted to institute as the primary driver for receptivity and compliance to receiving the injection, not healthcare, not public health, not supporting relationships between patients, physicians, nothing like that. It was, this is the way we want to do this because loss of employment will be the greatest motivating factor to ensure compliance. Secondly, the basis really for the mandate was that this alleged vaccine, this injection was the thing, the central actor in a multi-pronged approach to prevent transmissibility and retransmissibility, which was a lie from the beginning. Birx has confirmed that, Fauci has confirmed that, Walensky has confirmed that, the chief medical officer of the WHO has confirmed that. They had no data to support that contention, but it was the basis. Fortunately, it was the basis of the mandate because now the evidence that we presented in the Griner case strikes at the very heart of the hypotheses upon which the mandates rest.
Right. And I'm going to broaden this up for just a moment because I want the listeners to really understand why I have so many shows on the vaccine mandates. There's a reason for this. The reason is the vaccine mandates are the doorway to fascism. And the reason why is because they are forcing people to do what they don't want to do. Once that is allowed by our government to coerce people to take a medical treatment they do not want, we've lost our civil liberties. The only thing protected more by our Constitution than your own body and the right to reject things going into your body is the right to life itself. The right to life itself is fiercely guarded. You know, you have all sorts of rights before you can be subjected to capital punishment, of course. But the next, in my opinion, reading, you know, hundreds of cases over the years, the next right that's most fiercely protected is the right to leave your body alone, not to inject it, not to cut it, not to put chemicals into it. So, you know, environmental is a different issue. I'm not talking about environmental law. I'm talking about your body and medicine and medical treatment. And so the vaccine mandates are a big part of the whole fascist shift that's going on right now. Because first of all, it's causing enormous shifts in wealth from average Americans to the billionaires, the technocrats, and the pharmaceutical companies. So the enormous shift in wealth must be looked at, not to mention what's happening now with inflation and the market and the 401ks. People are losing so much money. They're losing power. They're losing buying power. Why are they doing this? They're scaring people. Why? Because scared people will accept communism. Scared people will take whatever they can get out of the rut they're in. They're trying to push people down, oppress them, so they will accept socialism and then communism. So this is why I keep talking about the vaccine mandates in the show. This is absolutely critical, and we've got to turn this around. These mandates are unconstitutional, clearly, in my mind. It is absolutely mind-boggling to me that they've gone this long, but I've looked at a lot of the cases. I've read the Supreme Court cases. I've read a lot of the lower cases. I know what's happening. And I want to tell you, I want to talk about the mechanics and the actual structure of your argument. Yeah. I think you have the strongest argument. I think you need to add to this. I mean, I think that in reading through the complaint and reading through the oral argument by Mr. Wentz, I think that you're kind of almost missing the boat a little bit. I don't want to be critical, but I'm, as a constitutional scholar, I want to tell you what I'm seeing. What I'm seeing is that medical mandates have, by and large, all been given heightened scrutiny throughout this nation's history. There's never been a U.S. Supreme Court case applying rational basis review to a vaccine mandate. Okay, the old case of Jacobson, I saw what the attorney government argued in the very beginning of the hearing on the motion for a preliminary injunction and the motion to dismiss, he starts saying that Jacobson applied rational basis review. That is absolute nonsense. That's what all the government lawyers are saying. The courts don't really know necessarily, so they tend to lean toward the government attorneys over the plaintiff's lawyers. That's just the way they're set up, the way they're geared. They often know each other, right, because the government attorneys are before the court all the time, and they're listening to these people who are telling them the law is something that it is not. And I was saying before at one of my shows that Josh Blackman from the South Texas College of Law wrote a fabulous article called the Irrepressible Myth of Jacobson versus Massachusetts. It's like this myth that keeps living on and on. That's a myth. Jacobson's appellate court, when he appealed his criminal conviction based on the Liberty Clause, so it's not the Supreme Court case, we're talking about the appeal on the conviction, that court said point blank, you and the state may disagree as to whether you should be vaccinated. Clearly, the court said the state could not force you to get vaccinated. However, the fine is reasonable under the circumstances. So the U.S. Supreme Court, after that, heard the case, and the U.S. Supreme Court said he's here arguing that his liberty interest protects him from a $5 fine. There was no issue of coercion. There was no vaccine mandate. It was either get the vaccine or pay $5. So how that's been, you know, morphed into this idea that they can force vaccines, it's ridiculous. But I noticed that there's a lot of emphasis in your case and in other cases about whether it's a vaccine or not. I understand the argument, but I think it's barking up the wrong tree. I think that whether you call it a vaccine or not is almost irrelevant because Jacobson does not stand for the concept that, that vaccine mandates are constitutional. So you don't need to, I don't think you need to worry about that. My concern about carving out an exception for vaccines or even acknowledging or accepting an exception for vaccines, I think it's a mistake. I think it's against constitutional law. And I think what the government will do is they'll start changing the definition of vaccines nonstop as they did in late 21 to whatever they want to give you. They'll just call it a vaccine. They'll change the definition. That's very dangerous. Vaccines are...
Well, yeah, we've already seen that they're willing to do that. I mean, we've seen over the last few years, they're willing to do things that we never would have presumed them willing to do, and willing to do it dishonestly out in the open.
So let me tell you what I've seen in terms of the mistake that I've seen being made in every single lawsuit so far. It's a mistake that's understandable if you haven't really studied fundamental rights analysis and taught it, because until you do that, you don't really get the structure down the way you do when you teach. When you teach, you have to teach it in component parts. You have to teach it in the steps. So the first thing the court's going to do is decide whether it's a fundamental right or not. If it's a fundamental right, you get strict scrutiny. And as we know, it's called strict in theory, fatal in fact. It's going to be very hard to pull those mandates because with all the evidence we have that they don't work, that the CDC committee itself recommended against the booster, for example, we've got all sorts of evidence. Once we get to strict scrutiny, they are not going to pass constitutional muster. So what every lawyer's done that I've seen so far in these cases is they have asserted a fundamental right. They've asserted it under Kruzan, under Harper, one of these cases. But they've asserted it without proving it. And here's the problem. No Supreme Court case has said there's a fundamental right to reject medication. The Supreme Court hasn't had to. The Supreme Court hasn't
been asked that question.
Not precisely. Not precisely. Right. And so what we need to do is ask the court to do that. And that's what my amicus brief for Nations in Action does. I am asking the Third Circuit to correct all the lower court's errors. And technically, they can only correct all the errors in their own Third Circuit until it gets to the Supreme Court. That's the only court that can affect every single court in the United States. The Supreme Court is above all courts. But what it would do is it would give a nice Third Circuit precedent that I think would be followed by the courts, because I don't know how you can look at the nation's history and tradition of protecting the body from government interference and not find a fundamental right. So what
that's where you've added so much is that you've created a clear historical context that goes almost back to, you know, habeas corpus and mandamus. I mean, you're going back to some very primary documents that are the foundation of Western law.
Well, that's what the court has asked us to do. And again, without being a con law scholar, you wouldn't know this. And I happen to specialize in the Liberty Clause, but without a background like that, you're not going to know this. But the court has told us repeatedly now in Glucksberg and recently in Dobbs when they overturned Roe v. Wade, that the first thing the court does is decide whether it's a fundamental right. And the first thing the court does for that is trace the history and tradition of the law. And while I think the federal courts should be doing that on their own, whether or not the attorneys present that information, the truth is they don't.
Yeah.
So that's why when Nations in Action, Maria Zach and I talked about this, I said, we need a brief like this to be filed. And she supported this brief. So Nations in Action is the amicus curiae. I'm the amicus curiae attorney. And I traced the law back to the 1200s. And I showed how there's never once been a case in this country where a medical mandate was subjected to rational basis review. Quite the contrary. In fact, even though under the Fourth Amendment, the test is reasonableness, and reasonableness sounds like rational basis review, under the Fourth Amendment, the court has applied a test that is not rational basis review in Winston versus Lee, and I think 1965, or, I'm sorry, it was later than that, 85, whatever it was. Winston versus Lee was a case where the government wanted to pull a bullet out of a suspect because he was identified as the person at the scene of the crime. He had a bullet lodged in his shoulder, and the shopkeeper was shot and said, hey, I got him back. I shot him back. So they wanted to pull the bullet out of this suspect, this violent criminal, to show by ballistic evidence that was him. And he did not want that bullet pulled out for obvious reasons. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, you can't do that. You're subjecting this man to pulling back muscle tissue. Unknown risk. One of the experts said, oh, it's not that deep. Another expert said, actually, it is kind of deep. It could affect the organs. The court said, we don't know the risks. We can't invade a human body like that, even though he was a, you know, attempted murderer. And we believe that because we have an eyewitness, the shopkeeper, saying that's him. And, you know, it is hard to convict without ballistic evidence. It's just it's one person against another with a very high burden of proof. But even with all that, the court said no. Even under the reasonableness Fourth Amendment standard, the court said no. So I didn't.
The history that led up to that Supreme Court decision, Dina, was that the conclusion of the district court that was affirmed as well, or did the district court reach a different decision and the Supreme Court corrected it by reaching that conclusion? Here's a fundamental right. We're not going to allow a battery on the person, you know, an unwanted touching.
Procedural background. I normally read Supreme Court cases. In this COVID crisis, I have read the lower court cases and the Supreme Court cases. But generally speaking, I just look at the head honcho. The head honcho is the Supreme Court.
Sure.
Whatever
sure.
they say goes. Sometimes they talk about, sometimes they don't. I don't recall that in that particular case. But my point's just a simple one. It doesn't matter which constitutional provision. It doesn't matter whether it's the Fourth Amendment right to avoid searches and seizures. It doesn't matter whether it's just general due process before the rights were incorporated. It doesn't matter whether it's Liberty Clause like we have right now. The court has consistently applied some kind of heightened review when the government wants to poke into your body, cut into your body, make you ingest a drug. That is just not done. And for the government attorneys to claim that Jacobson supports that now is just it's just disingenuous. It's intellectual fraud. And maybe they don't know, but it sure seems like they should know. So
as I had mentioned to you when we spoke initially about this case, to us, the significance of the case is for us is winning.
Absolutely.
This is an opportunity to win a very significant issue, not just for Dr. Greiner, but for the country.
Yeah.
And to actually stop, actually create, lay the groundwork of a bulwark. And you made that clear yesterday in terms of identifying the lack of understanding. And so, you know, if we can serve that purpose as well, to clarify the law, to drive a stake in the ground where there has been one driven in the ground for a while. Put an orange flag on it, you know, raise the flag above it, whatever.
Right.
I think it's, we don't have egos involved here. We want to be best prepared, best arguments for best outcomes. Right. So
whoever wins in the U.S. Supreme Court wins for the entire country and probably the entire world. One of the things I did in the recent briefs, I cited an Italian court out of Florence, and this court found the booster shots to be unconstitutional under the Italian Constitution and the German Constitution. She kind of went out on a little dictum there and said, these shots, we don't even know what's in them. How can we possibly assess whether these are safe for our people, whether they can be forced to take them if we don't even know what's in the vaccines, not to mention the high death toll after the booster, the third shot? There's more people dying from that than anything else. So, yeah, I mean, and this is another thing to impress upon the viewers or the listeners is when we get our ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court, and I believe we will, whether it's your case, whether it's Dana Weaver's case, when we get Supreme Court and we win just this one issue, that this is a fundamental right and therefore a very different, a much harder constitutional test applies when the government tries to defend their mandates, we're all going to win. And so you're in a great procedural place. You haven't.
We have great facts. We have great facts as well, don't we?
Remember, though, the facts don't matter until you get the proper standard of judicial review. Because if they apply rational basis review, the court, no matter what the government argues, the court can say, and I am not joking here, the court can say, I'm going to make up my own reason. I find a reason, he can just pull one out of the sky. Yep. And he or she can use that reason to uphold the law under rational basis review. But under strict scrutiny, the government has a very difficult burden to prove the efficacy of the vaccine, to prove it works, to prove there's no safer, less intrusive alternatives. All the burdens shift.
Everything. Everything that we've seen happen in the last 2 years in terms of removing less intrusive, more safe, more effective means and actually making statements in deceptive ways, in deceptive promotional activities as well, that these things are safe and effective. So I agree with you entirely. Let me ask you another question, because there's a broader context for the application of these cases as well, where a strict scrutiny standard would apply, and that's the how would that relate to the World Health Organization's efforts and our complicity, our country's, our government's complicity in handing over healthcare under pandemic definitions to a non-U.S. organization?
WHO is irrelevant. They're nobody. They're a self-proclaimed entity. They're trying to be the government. They're meaningless. They're worthless. The Supreme Court should not listen to a thing the WHO says. The Supreme Court might consider some of the CDC findings or FDA findings unless they have other experts saying you shouldn't listen to that. And then they have to consider the credibility of the FDA and the CDC. But the WHO is irrelevant. They have no credibility as far as I'm concerned. They are not government. They're not elected. They're not even appointed by anyone but themselves. And you have a self-appointed group of billionaires trying to create policy for the rest of us. And unfortunately, our people are so ignorant, so not well-trained in schools. And that's another thing about what our government has done. They've made our people helpless because our people don't know better. But speaking of, you know, hiding the ball and creating confusion and intellectual dishonesty, let's talk about what this attorney, Mr. McElvain, is that his name, Mr. McElvain?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Joel McElvain, here we are in the Utah court. By the way, what circuit is Utah in?
10th.
Okay, so, listen to what he says.
Yeah, this is the lawyer, Dina, this is the lawyer who, when President Trump, or when the DOJ, President Trump's initial attorney general, remind me his name, his first attorney general, refused to prevent Republicans from giving, creating legislative help to Obamacare. This is the lawyer who resigned from the DOJ. It happened to be 4 years from the date of his resignation from the DOJ that he's back at the DOJ under Biden arguing, an oral argument in this case. The timing on this was really funny.
Well, I want to talk about, because I literally laughed out loud. I brought this transcript that you gave me from the July 6th hearing, and there were cross motions, one motion to dismiss from the government and your motion, or well, not yours, but you're involved in this, the plaintiff's lawyers, Dr. Greiner's motion for a preliminary injunction to halt the enforcement of the mandate. And listen to what this guy says. Listen to what Joel McElvain says. He talks about the 1918 influenza and how this COVID-19 is the deadliest disease in American history. First of all, that is not true. But even if it was, it doesn't mean much. All they have to show is a compelling interest and that they have to move on to the next test if we're doing strict scrutiny. Otherwise, I mean, he's going on and listen to this. Here's the problem with even talking about this. He starts bringing up Biden versus Missouri. Biden versus Missouri never discussed the facts of how deadly the virus was, whether the vaccine worked or not. And Justice Thomas made that very clear in the end. And the reason why they didn't discuss it was because the Liberty Clause claim was not before them. The claim before them was a statutory construction claim. And listen to what this Mr. McIlvaine says. He starts saying that Biden versus Missouri, I'm going to quote this here, that the COVID-19 virus can spread rapidly among healthcare workers and from them to patients. He's trying to prove facts concerning substantive due process that were never considered really by the court. They were talking statutory construction, meaning they did not really have to decide whether the vaccine was safe or effective, whether the COVID-19 infection was serious, whether it killed one person or 10 billion people. That wasn't before them, because they were determining whether the statute that gave the power to the Secretary of Health had the power, whether it was delegated power or not, to create a vaccine mandate. The court said yes in a 5-4 decision. But this attorney is trying to use dictum from that case that was not necessary to decide the case to create new precedents saying, oh, and they can do this under substantive due process. It had nothing to do with substantive due process. That's what bothered me so much when I started reading this attorney's arguments. And this is what I see all the time from government attorneys. They are not that good, but they manage to confuse the courts a lot. And, you know, they get an F in con law class. They get an F for this. You can't apply, you know, statutory construction analysis to substantive due process. They're completely different types of analysis. And then you start saying that Jacobson created rational basis review. No, Jacobson's 1905. Rational basis review came in U.S. versus Caroline Products, 1942, as I recall, the famous fourth footnote. Okay, we're talking 37 years later. Jacobson couldn't have applied rational basis review because it hadn't been created by the court yet.
It hadn't been created. Right.
Again, this is intellectual dishonesty or laziness or just I don't even know what it is, but it's not right to do this as an attorney. Is he a U.S. attorney or an attorney? Let's see. Is this man a U.S. attorney? Yeah, U.S. Department of Justice. The U.S. attorney.
Yeah. He's DOJ, yeah.
Unbelievable. Because I know enough about how they hire U.S. attorneys. They're normally top
20. They're usually sharp people. Yeah. Top
sharp.
Class
from top 20 law schools. That's all my friends who made it in the U.S. Attorney's Office were top of their class at USC or UCLA. They don't even really hire out of Loyola or University of Houston or anything that isn't a top 20 law school. And you have to be top of your class from one of those law schools. So, you know, this person should know better, and that's why I'm calling it intellectual dishonesty. I don't know for sure. I don't know his intent, but it sure isn't right what he argued. And then he's saying there's and this is something that I was concerned a little bit about. He starts talking about the criminal prosecution, first of all. And I saw in another case the attorney arguing that, oh, Jacobson was such a bigger penalty. It was a criminal penalty. Okay, it was $5. Okay, and I said that really that argument that any criminal penalty is so much worse than any civil penalties such as losing your job, losing your house. That argument was foreclosed by New York Times versus Sullivan in 1964. Mm. That argument's been foreclosed. But see, they don't know this. These are not constitutional scholars. The Supreme Court said in that case that sometimes civil penalties are way, way worse than criminal penalties. In that case, the civil fine imposed was 1,000 times more than the highest fine, the criminal fine that could have been imposed under Alabama law. So you see, that's kind of a silly argument to me. Is it, okay, it's criminal. I'd rather take a criminal citation for, you know, I don't know, littering than lose my job and lose my house. And everyone feels the same way. So that's a silly argument. But the thing that kind of bugged me more was when he started talking about how there's been no due process right. Okay, here's another point that's confusing. There is clearly a due process right to avoid medication. The question is whether it's fundamental. So the court has said previously, like in Cruzan and in the hospital.
That's the distinction I picked up in your amicus brief.
That's what's so important about
the
amicus
brief. That's the line in the sand. That's the distinction.
We know we have a liberty interest. We all know that. The question is it a fundamental liberty interest or not? Because there's a liberty
that's
interest.
That's where your historical context really comes into play.
That's where constitutional law comes in, because you know, there's a right to wear a mustache. There's a liberty interest in having long hair. But when you're a police officer, that liberty interest is overwhelmed by the need for a certain decorum, you know, it's not that there's not a liberty interest in wearing long hair or dressing the way you want or having a lot of pierced ears. It's that it's not a fundamental right. And so without being a fundamental right, you're going to have a lower standard of review. And especially when you're a government employee, or you're in prison as in Harper, there's a little bit of a different standard. But the bottom line is once a fundamental right is determined and you're not in custody, strict scrutiny applies. And these mandates cannot possibly withstand strict scrutiny. So that's why the whole brief is about, my brief is all about showing this is a fundamental right. And all the courts have gotten it wrong, as Josh Blackman showed so eloquently. And in fact, you read the Josh Blackman article, it'll blow your mind. These courts are making up stuff. They're making findings that the court held this or that. When no, the court did not hold that. One justice made a comment, like a stray comment in a dissent or in the concurring opinion. The court did not say that. The court did not hold that. So again, we're back to the intellectual dishonesty among the courts and the government attorneys when they're just making stuff up and saying things were found that were not found by the court.
Well, I don't think there's I don't think it's arguable. I think it's inarguable that the integrity of the judicial system now is more, I don't know if you could ever say it's actually more important than ever, but it has been called into question. And we did have a Supreme Court justice trying to enter evidence or trying to enter information into evidence in the Missouri case, you know. There was a justice who spoke from the bench about the severity of the numbers of children in the hospitals and all these kinds of things, information that was not in evidence in an effort to try to persuade.
It's so sleazy. I told you I went to trial against an attorney, Drew Harris, from Ken Paxton's office. And talk about sleazy lawyering. I mean, this man introduced an affidavit that had been recanted. The declarant had agreed it was inaccurate. Had been recanted, and he introduces this into evidence during trial. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that's clearly irrelevant. Put into evidence that I have a beach house in Malibu, which I do not have a beach house in Malibu. The houses in the hills are often run down, and a fraction of the cost, a tiny, tiny fraction of the cost. They may cost 1% or 3%. Of what a Malibu Beach house would cost, but they did that intentionally, and I have reason to believe that was, in fact, that whole statement was created for the litigation. I have all sorts of evidence that they actually had students writing ridiculous things into teaching evaluations to try to get them in. Of course, they're hearsay. They're anonymous hearsay. The court lets them in. I mean, it was so bad what went on, but I was so disgusted because I talked to other female plaintiffs, and they had the same problem. The same lawyer, Drew Harris, the same man, would not give another very nice young TSU law grad witness names. In her lawsuit, she had filed a lawsuit. She was entitled to discovery. And then Pat Garrison dealt with a different lawyer from Ken Paxton's office, and she's testified that she was run around. They wouldn't give documents up. Same with me. They make you file motion to compel after motion to compel. They break your wallet. It's called wallet whipping in Texas. Sure. So this is what our attorney general is doing in Texas. Where is the justice? And by the way, it's their obligation to. This law school has so much sexual assault inside the law school, not just against students. We're talking professor on professor sexual assault. They do nothing about it. Then when a woman sues, they go after the woman. They won't provide the evidence. They provide falsified evidence. Now, the attorney general's office can say they didn't know that the evidence was false, but it clearly was if you compare the W-2s to, for example, the stated payments by the school and that kind of thing. So we're dealing with not just, you know, one problem. We're dealing with a whole system that has largely been skewed away from justice. And we don't even know necessarily whether some of these judges are part of the cabal or just right. clueless. Right. But I can tell you.
Let's talk about that specifically, because in the Griner case, Judge Kimball is an octogenarian. He's an 84-year-old judge that was, Orrin Hatch was the senator who actually, put him up for the position. I think, 70, over 70 days beyond oral argument.
Mm-hmm. And no decision.
We've submitted, he kept our ability to submit evidence open and made that very clear at the end of oral argument. We've submitted several pieces of additional evidence by motion, which he has granted. And so know, there are two motions in this case that have been granted thus far, and they favor us. There are motions, and the judge granted them. The evidence that we submitted, I've referred to some of that, the Burks testimony, the Fauci testimony, the Walensky testimony, the emails from the CDC, definition changing, that kind of, scrambled egg approach to try to change minds and stay on top of their deception. But that's where we are procedurally, Dina. That's where we're procedural, where, oral argument that the transcript there was dated July 6th.
Yeah, I know. I saw how low it was. Well, I think you, I'll tell you what I would do in your case. I would file a motion for summary judgment on the issue of what standard of review to apply. I would file a motion for summary judgment that this, as a matter of law, involves a fundamental right. And I would submit my amicus brief or something like it. I could do one for you, or you could, I guess, now that it's out, people are going to use it. And I get that's kind of what Nations in Action and I wanted. We wanted to get it out there so it can be used. I would love to help on your case, and I would love to do some oral arguments, because I think one of the things that people get in trouble with is if they haven't really studied constitutional law in depth is they get into before the U.S. Supreme Court, and the court's asking them questions about, all kinds of cases, any kind of substantive due process case, and they may not know them. And I saw one really good lawyer make some really big mistakes. I'll tell you, it was Snyder versus Phelps, and the lawyer is a really good lawyer from what I've heard. I don't know the man, but when he was asked point blank, is there a difference between the sidewalk picketing and the online epic? And he did not really address that. And the answer is absolutely, there's a difference. I mean, a whole different level of invasion. And at some point, invasion has to be actionable, even if it involves free speech. Otherwise, you could just yell out, Biden's a rat as you rape someone. And you say, that's what one of my friends, another professor, said. Are you kidding me? If you say that as long as it's political speech, you can get away with it, you can do all sorts of things. And we were making up all these different scenarios, like something like that, something crazy.
Hypotheticals.
You can't move something into free speech just by, using some speech involved with extremely hurtful, extremely invasive, extremely tortious conduct. And I wrote about that. But the mistake he made was, that was one mistake. Another mistake was in the issue presented in that case to the U.S. Supreme Court. He only discussed the sidewalk picketing. He didn't mention the online epic in the question presented. Now, the court went round and round and round in oral argument about whether the online epic was the same issue as the sidewalk picketing. And my answer is no, because sidewalk right. picketing has been fierce. You don't want, that's the First Amendment right to picket the sidewalk, especially because they adhere to the local laws, staying back from the funeral procession. Right. This was Matthew Snyder, who was killed in the line of duty, and a church Westboro whose website is GodHatesFag.com, loving church, you can see. They came to picket his funeral saying that God hates fags, and I'm quoting God Hates Fags, what they said. And, Semper Fi, the stuff they said was so offensive, but that's free speech. And unfortunately, it is. But making a whole website against the family, that's a different level. But because it wasn't put in the question presented, it wasn't before the court. And so even though the court round and rounding oral argument, footnote one of the court's ultimate decision said, we're not going to discuss the online epic because it wasn't in the question presented. So you need, that's why you need a certified appellate lawyer involved, in my opinion, at the Supreme Court level. That's why you need a constitutional scholar to understand what a vast difference it is between sidewalk picketing, a historical, long-term, highly protected mode of speech, versus a private website against a family, attacking a family that has, goodness, for these people.
You've got a very persuasive argument. There's no, the moment now, and it's a strange thing. You began our conversation with noting this, that the fulcrum upon which authoritarianism and totalitarianism tips relative to individual liberties. Mm-hmm. And we're really at that, we're at these inflection points now, because so much we've seen the actions of mayors and governors. We've seen even down to county level, even down to school board meetings, we've seen the inflection point of the authoritarian hearts of American citizens willing to intentionally inflict suffering. The definition of cruelty, willing to inflict suffering with agency. Actually choosing to do this through political means, through policies, implementing policies that actually are cruel by intent and design. And so I do think we're at a very significant moment historically in the country where you do have this this one issue, a single issue in which so much of the argument between liberty and slavery turns. And that's the autonomy over our bodies. So it's, you know, the Griner case is ripe for that.
Yeah.
You know, ripe to act as that, as a fulcrum in that battle. So I said it before, even I think yesterday and today, I've reiterated multiple times, this isn't about ego. This is about a right outcome.
Absolutely.
The best outcome, not just for Dr. Griner, but for the country.
Absolutely. All the people who know anything about how to handle this case should come together as a group and form liaison committees or whatnot. And that's how things get done. That's what we're doing. It's been an enormous sifting process. A lot of us met, you know, a year and a half ago. I can tell you pretty much everyone I met at the get-go. I met through Bobby Kennedy with the PCR group that we had. I met Reiner Fulmich that way. I met, all sorts of people that way. And then we just, one thing led to another, you know, and Reiner then create a group, and I met Gigi Foster and other people. Anyway, you're listening to Revolution Radio. We're discussing a case called Griner versus Biden coming up the ranks right now. It's in the district court in Utah. It's going to come to the 10th Circuit and then hopefully to the U.S. Supreme Court. Please get on freedomslips.com today and make a donation. Your donations keep us on the air, and our station is 100% listener sponsored, so please do. We don't have advertisements, as you probably have noticed, and that's why, because our listeners are the ones supporting us. So thank you for your donations, and please keep it up. I want to say something else about your briefs that I like so much. I saw this dual sovereignty structure argument, which I am I've been yapping up and down to everyone who will listen, that, you know, we've never had a federal agency or actor do a vaccine mandate. I mean, this is crazy. All the cases, even the cases that went to court, it was always the legislature creating a vaccine mandate for children in the regular course of legislation. And the first thing we see in these cases is a complete lack of due process at the front end, at the promulgation stage. No one was given due process. When something comes before the legislature, a committee is formed, they research it, they listen to experts, they have hearings, they make findings, and they make recommendations. Then the legislature
votes on it.
Due process. People have the right to come in. The public has a right to notice. The public has a right to object. All that was sidestepped by this pandemic emergency and this sudden executive, you know, rulemaking, which was insane. And so I say in my motion to the court for the amicus brief, which is pending in the Third Circuit now, in Skedney versus New Jersey and Murphy, they sued the governor there too, is that especially when there's no due process at the front end, we've got to have due process at the back end, and that's the court's review. And yet the courts are just throwing up their hands and not doing anything about it, either because they don't want to do the right thing or because they really don't know. And I don't know the answer, but I can tell you, anyone who reads the amicus brief, I spent a lot of time on it, I think it makes very clear that this is a fundamental right. And once that is found by a court, I don't see how anyone could possibly say it's not, because it derives from the law of battery, which has been in place since the 1200s. We've always had a right not to have our bodies touched, not to mention our constitutional law of the past century, which says, I think it makes it very clear. So, but your dual
one of the beautiful things about the creating the historical context, you know, candidly, as one of the non-constitutional lawyers in the room, that identifying the source and origin of this fundamental right of bodily autonomy being sourced out of the common law of and ancient laws of trespass and battery make it so understandable.
I mean, there's things that
make it so understandable and so persuasive. I mean, sometimes I think people, lawyers' eyes will gloss over when you start talking constitutional law because of the minefields and intricacies and all these other things that it's perceived to be, which are real. But in this particular case, creating that, and judges are presented with minefields and then asked to make a decision, and they can't, their decisions are rarely going to be any better than the briefs and arguments that they get from the lawyers. They're just not going to be better, right? They're going to answer the questions that they're asked. And so, and positioning this, the bodily autonomy question as a fundamental right, tying it right back to trespass and battery, make it a very, I don't know.
I mean, this is
litigated. Most of the law that I practiced in the last 15 years of my practice was international commodity transactions. But when I had some experience in litigation, I knew that if I could make the decision easier for the judge, the probability of prevailing was significantly higher. Make it easy for the judge to decide for me.
And that's what my lawyers failed to do, is they've cited Cruzan and said we have a fundamental right. Cruzan didn't say that. Cruzan didn't adopt strict scrutiny. Cruzan was a different kind of case. They were just trying to decide whether a state could require, by clear and convincing evidence, proof that the person who is unconscious would have pulled the plug, basically. That's all they were looking at. And the court said, yes, they can require that higher burden of proof to assure that the person who's unconscious is having their will met and their desire met, because a mistake is terminal. It is literally terminal. You can't undo it. And that's what the court said. But the thing is, there's a difference between asserting the right to reject, the right of bodily autonomy versus proving there's a fundamental right. And I think that's what we need to do. I think it's what we will do. I think it's what this amicus brief does do. And I think that once we get there, we're in good shape. But I want to go back to the dual sovereignty just for a minute, because I love this argument. I'm so happy you have us before the court. I believe this is a winning argument. And remember, courts will always leave the constitutional issues for last. This is the standard operating procedure. They will not answer constitutional issues unless they have to.
Right.
And so if you can win on the dual sovereignty, it's easier for the court to win on that in a sense, just because they won't have to get into the Liberty Clause issue. But you mentioned something to me, and the dual sovereignty is a 10th Amendment issue. All the areas of law that aren't specifically listed in Article 1, Section 8 as congressional powers, immigration, declaring war, creating federal courts, those things. Everything else is left to the states. That's called federalism. The state power, federal power and the state power, and they have to be shared. Unlike separation of powers, which is lateral. This is the federal and state powers. And I think you have a strong argument there. But you said something to me that I had to stop and think about this. You said to me, someone said to you, how are you going to get past Biden versus Missouri in your case? Do you remember that?
Yep.
Can I ask who said that? Here's the answer. Biden versus Missouri, no one raised a substantive due process claim. It was never before.
Right.
You're going to get you guys slide right around that, because that case does not affect this case. Not on the substantive due process claim and not on the dual sovereignty claim that also wasn't addressed.
Yeah.
I think you have the winning case here. I think you're one of them.
Well, thanks, Daniel. I'll contribute to George West. He's a phenomenal specialist in that dual sovereignty. I'll send you a brief
freedomsolicitor.com, and we'll be right back after this message.
Revolution Radio, Studio B, at 11 a.m. on Saturday for Free Association, when we take a look at philosophy, spirituality, psychology, social issues and geopolitics. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Studio B at freedomslips.com.